I always start out asking where you came from and why you came to Alaska.
Well, I came from southern Indiana, and when I was a teenager, we were in the midst of the Depression, and we were farmers about a mile and a half from a little town called Merrim, and it used to have a Christian college there, but it had gone bankrupt. And anyway, some people in Chicago University had this bright idea. They were going to try some experiments and see if they could improve the economy of some small town, and they picked this little town to do it. And you know, the best employed people were on WPA, and there just wasn't any money around, so they had found a fella from Denmark named Haljemars Rutzebeck, and they sent him over to this little town, and he was going to show them how to start a cooperative for the community. And this little town was about 500 population. But anyway, he had to, they used this old college building, and he said the first thing we have to do is build a big round table so that everybody can sit around the table and everybody can look at everybody. There won't be anybody sitting behind you. He figured, and that, you know, that's really not a bad theory. And he thought of different things that people could do to make some money, although nobody had any money. So there were a lot of farmers that had fence rows that had grown up over the years, and he said, well, now, wouldn't you like to have your fence rows maybe cleared out? And they did have some special connections to Chicago University and some of the richer people out in the northern part of Chicago. So they said, well, we'll get some people to cut down the trees and then cut firewood, and then we'll haul it to Chicago. Seemed like kind of a dumb thing, but it worked. And then they got paid for the wood, and then they bought different things that people needed. Nobody got any money, but everybody worked for points. You got a certain number of points for doing this or that. And some farmers had some spare land, and they said, well, couldn't we use some of your land for a watermelon patch or a cantaloupe patch? And so they did that. And they did many different things. Our family, though, was kind of interested in all these kind of things. Now, we weren't unemployed because we owned a farm, so we were busy all the time. But we did help out the community different ways. And this fella came out to our farm, and he used to tell the most wonderful stories. He'd homesteaded in Alaska, and he was down in Homer, and so he used to tell these stories about how exciting Alaska was. And I thought, boy, if I ever get a chance, I'm going to go to Alaska. So when I joined the Air Force, I had gone to airplane engine mechanic school, and then I went to helicopter specialist school. And when I graduated, they said, well, we have two openings, one down the Panama Canal and one in Alaska. And I said, well, I'd sure like Alaska.
Okay, so when was this?
This was back in 1947, when I shipped up here in 47. And I came up on a troop ship and landed at Whittier, and then came through the tunnel and was at Anchorage for a little while, and then flew up to Fairbanks, and I was stationed at Ladd Air Force Base then.
Hmm.
And so that tells you how I got here and why I got here.
Right, okay. But you went to school at the university, right?
When I got out of the service, mm-hmm. And then I went to university and graduated with a degree in agriculture.
One of the first ones, I understand.
One of the last ones.
The last
official one.
Oh, is that right? Huh.
Joe Lawler was ahead of me 1 year,
uh-huh.
And we were both going to be college professors, and we had it all worked out, but we were on the wrong political team. Joe did finally go ahead and you know, work at a college down in California, but my wife was so tired of me studying by the time I graduated, because I was taken up to 23, 24 hour course, you know.
Credits.
And she said, "Oh, please take a year off. I had plenty of GI Bill left to go ahead and get my doctor's degree, and I was going to go to Cornell and work in genetics, and it was pretty exciting. And but I took a year off, and then Joe Lawler talked me into working for the little farmers co-op that was kind of down on its uppers, and I was working as a carpenter after school. Well, I'd work during college too in the summertime to make money. And so he just said it was, you know, so important that I go and help out the little farmers co-op. And being young and kind of impressionable, I really thought I might help. One of the first things I did when I got there, I found out we were being sued because they hadn't paid for the building yet, you know.
So who owned the building?
Well, Slater had the mortgage. I don't know. Paul Elbert had gotten the building built, but somehow they just had never gotten around to finish paying for it. And
this was the concrete block building on
the big
on Second Avenue?
No, this was the one over there by Hayford's Greenhouse, the one that Lee Rissy bought now.
Oh.
Yeah,
it was right.
The old root cellar, right?
The old root cellar, yeah. And that's where Pete Akin had his bar and stuff. And
right.
And his son died in it. And
right.
So, anyway, Joe Lawler had lined up a lawyer. It was Mike Stepovich. And then their lawyer was, you know, and I forgot it, but he was a really great lawyer. But anyway, I went to see Mike about what we'd do about this situation. Of course, we had no money, but I thought I better try to figure out what to do. And so Mike called up the other lawyer, and the other lawyer said, "Well, just tell him he should pay it, you know." So that was the end of our big lawyer business. Mike went on to be governor, but
well, so what happened with the building?
Well, we did go ahead and pay for it, and you know, it took a while, but we got it all paid off. And and I had to do a lot of carpenter work. That was one reason Joe wanted me to work there, so that I could build bins and do all. If somebody isn't there to give it tender loving care, it doesn't get done, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would go to Chamber of Commerce meetings and give away free potatoes, because every once in a while, some of the local farmers would take advantage of some store owner, and then they had a. I remember Lindy's grocery said, "Boy, I'll never buy any more local stuff." He said, "It's so terrible." So you just really had to do some campaigning and, you know, and stuff. And of course, when I went in there, they had no delivery truck. They had no anything, really, you know. So I used my car to deliver potatoes to the stores and things. And I think Art Buswell was our first potato inspector. He was at the university. He was one of my professors. And they tried out this inspection program. Well, he was, I think, the first inspector, and then I stayed with the co-op for a year or so, and that's how I got involved in getting homesteaded. You see, you meet all these nice people, and everybody said, "Well, you know, you really ought to get a homestead. I mean, everybody ought to have a homestead."
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know
what you were getting into.
What you're getting into, you know, and some people lived on the Badger Road, and they said, "Boy, there's some nice land out here," and then other people were different places, and finally we settled out here. We knew Bert Stemple, and you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, were Pat's folks already out here?
No, we homesteaded the same year. Pat had come to Alaska the year before I did. She came up in 46 over the highway, and they brought most of their worldly possessions. They couldn't bring the piano and the horse, but they did. They had a house trailer and a big steak bed truck that they put a lot of stuff on. They had a year's supply of food when they came up, because back in those days you had to carry all your gas and oil. You weren't allowed on the highway unless you had a year's supply of stuff.
Briefly, where did they come from?
Well, they came from California. They were in June Lake. That's on the eastern side of the mountains. And they had a little resort business there, Pat had grown up in the Los Angeles area, and they'd lived in the San Francisco area, and they loved to be out in the country and stuff. And when they heard that they were going to put street lights in that little town, they said, well, it's time to get out, because that's too much civilization. I mean, so they had read a book on Alaska, and they were going to go to Palmer and Wasilla area. That's where they were going to go. So they started out in the fall, which wasn't a real smart thing, but they didn't know how cold Alaska could be. So they came, they got everything together, and they bought this little house trailer, and somebody had talked them into buying just a 6-foot wide house trailer instead of an 8-foot wide, because they said the roads are pretty narrow. And of course the roads were bad. There were a lot of it corduroy and a lot of it mud and stuff. And then they had a station wagon, and then they had another trailer behind that. And they did bring, I think it was 7 collie dogs and 3 cats and a parrot. So they were equipped, you see. And, they got as far as White Horse, and they broke down. And the people in White Horse let them park their trailer in the little park in the middle of town. And then it took Pat's dad, I don't know, several weeks to get the parts, because it wasn't easy to get parts back in 1946. You couldn't buy anything new on it all. So anyway, they were quite of excitement for the kids, because they'd stop by the trailer on the way to school and on the way back from school, and they'd play with the cats and the dogs, and they were really excited about the parrot, because most of them had never seen a parrot before. And Pat still had friends down in White Horse that she made when she was down there, when she was real young. So anyway, they finally got it fixed up, and then they started on up the highway, and it was getting near fall. I mean, fall had come now, and it was getting near winter, and they only had one set of tire chains. So, and then Pat's mother decided that she refused to drive at night. I mean, she wanted to be able to see what the road looked like, because it wasn't much of a road, because every bridge had a right angle turn on both ends. I mean, you couldn't go straight across anything. You'd come down the hill, made a right angle turn, go across the bridge, and then have another right angle turn to go up. And the bridge speed, I think, was 5 miles an hour to cross the bridges, because they weren't that well made. And anyway, when they started running into ice and snow, then they'd have to put the chains on to pull this, the truck had to put the chains on to pull this trailer up the hill. And they had some neighbors there in June Lake that came with them, and they also had a truck and a trailer, but they didn't have a station wagon and another trailer. So they could kind of travel together, but they'd only go about 100 miles a day, because they'd have to put on chains at the bottom of the hill, take them off the top of the hill, because they didn't want to wear them out. And then they'd go till they had to get up another hill, and they'd have to stop and put the chains on. So they finally got to the border, I think about Christmas time. And it was cold, and I think they were near Beaver Creek. Anyway, then they had some more trouble. Well, Pat's dad got his truck started one day, and then he went to pull his friend's truck to get it started, and when he did, he tore the rear end out of his truck, because neither one of them knew anything about cold weather and oil and grease and that kind of stuff. So then her dad had to come to Fairbanks to get some repairs and stuff. So they were stuck down at the border in this little trailer, and they did have a wood stove in it because they had to keep the trailer warm enough so the parrot and the dogs and stuff wouldn't freeze, you see. Had to keep the animals from freezing. Well, somebody was very nice and they gave them a caribou. So when they needed the meat, the caribou was just laying out in the yard. And so when they needed some meat, my Pat would go out with an axe and she'd chop off a chunk of caribou, and then they'd take it in and pick all the hairs off that they could get off, you know, and so then they could have caribou stew along with some potatoes and other stuff. But they had brought, I don't know how many dozens of eggs, and they had them in water glass, but they were in water glass, but they still froze, you see, and so they were all solid, and it was quite exciting. But then when they did finally get the truck fixed, they moved on to Tok, and they got the Tok about the time that the people running the lodge down there had just about had it, because it was the coldest winter they'd ever had, and it was down, I think, around 70 below zero. And the people said, we're going to get out of here. We never want to see Alaska again. And so they said, well, would you be interested in running the lodge? So, well, Pat's dad said, well, they might. And so they checked with the owner. I can't remember. The lodge was made out of old barracks buildings that came up from Haines. They were hauled up there, and that became the Tok Lodge. And that winter, they'd use 55 gallons of oil every day, you know, to keep the place going. They'd have to roll a barrel of oil in, you know, and put it inside where it thawed enough they could, they could use it in their stoves and stuff. And it did officially get down to 83 below in Snag, and it probably was the same temperature in Tok. That is the coldest spot in Alaska. So they never did get to Palmer, because Pat's dad kept coming to Fairbanks to get parts, because that was the closest way. And so then they moved to Delta the next year. I mean, that summer they went on to Delta, and they were there for a while, and then they came to Fairbanks, and he worked in the powerhouse at university. And Pat and I met at the Presbyterian Church. She and her mother walked in. Well, back in those days, Weeks Field was the big airport, and there was no College Road, and their house was out there in the middle of where Airport Road is now, pretty close to where the Lutheran Church is. So in order to get there, you had to walk around Weeks Field and then come back to get to their place, and they would walk to church even at 50 below zero so they could both sing in the choir. And Pat had the long golden hair. She just looked so pretty, you know, and I used to sit in the congregation and watch her, and then she went to the young people's group, and there were several of us GIs that went there too, and we got together, and we lived together for 46 years.
That long, yeah.
Yeah, so I thought she'd outlive me at least 20 years, you know, because her mother didn't die until, you know, she's 95.
I know.
I figured Pat ought to be good for that long. She was never sick. Pat was never sick, which was a wonderful thing, but they say people who are never sick get cancer.
Well, I don't know.
How disgusting that is. Huh?
Yeah. So you all homesteaded at the same time, then?
Yeah, we found two homesteads.
Mm-hmm.
Well, her folks homesteaded the one on the road, and we homesteaded back off the road. And that we bought a little John Deere crawler tractor from the NC company, And of course, back in those days, you could buy anything you needed for anything at the NC company. You could buy fawn rigs, and you could, for mining, and you could buy tractors, and you could buy cars, and of course, any kind of groceries you needed. And
well, Lee Rissy mentioned some kind of a little radish harvester.
Well, my mother-in-law did buy a radish harvester. She supplied the military with radishes a couple of years, and they started out doing it by hand, and then we got the little harvester, and it did help quite a bit.
I've never heard of it. Now, was that through NC too?
I'm trying to remember where we got that. I think we got it from somebody in Palmer. We didn't buy it new. We just found somebody down there had it, and then they decided to give it up because it's a lot of hard work to it, no matter what. All the washing, and then you got to inspect them and be sure you don't have root maggots and all that kind of stuff. You know, remember the early crop of radishes? It's just so wonderful about root maggots.
Indeed. So. Was the gun sight part of your homestead?
No, we were around it. See, that was an anti-aircraft battery that surrounded Ladd Air Force Base, and there were eight of them. One's on the farmer's loop there where George Dornath lives, and there was one here, and there's some out on the Badger Road area and out in South Fairbanks. I'm not sure where they all were, but there were eight altogether, and it was there. They had 45 acres, and Johnny Holm owned up to their north border, and then we homesteaded on the south side of the, Pat's folks homesteaded on the road, and they went alongside the military site, and then our homesteads joined in the back.
Okay, well then, were you coming in on what is now the Hot Springs Road at that time?
Yeah, it had only been open for just a few years, because that valley there by the Bitter Road was almost impassable. Mm-hmm. Well, and it was even for a few years after we homesteaded. But the area got kind of opened up when the military decided to put in that anti-aircraft battery, and so, as you know, all these roads start out, I don't know who started the Steel Creek Road, but it was called the Steel Creek Road because it went to the Steel Creek and died, but somebody would homestead, and then they'd have guests, and somebody said, well, that piece next to you is not too bad. I think I'll homestead that. So then they'd build a little trail to their place, and then somebody would say, well, that other piece, that's not so bad. And so they'd go on, they finally, I guess they had a little bridge there at the Steel Creek for a while, and then they finally got it told me. But I remember when the Brockmans lived out here, they had a chicken farm, and they raised eggs, and they would drive their tractor to the Steel Creek with their eggs, and then they'd leave the tractor on this side of the road and this side of the creek, and then they'd cross the creek and take their stuff to town. And they left a car on the other side, and of course Tilly was a wonderful cook, and she worked at the Model Cafe, and he worked at the lumber yard, Fairbanks Lumber.
Do you remember the Peerless? She had something to do with the Peerless earlier, and I think maybe it was.
She might have, but I don't remember. The model was the one, the big one. That's where the Chamber of Commerce met.
Right.
That's where some of the most important things in town took place.
Yep. Indeed. So when did the road from the Steel Creek at the top of the hill go back toward your place? Because somebody suggested that was maybe in use even earlier than the Hot Springs Road coming from the highway.
Well, as people developed along the Steel Creek, Bert Stemple had gotten Dr. Fitz's son's homestead because he decided not to stay in. And
who was this?
Dr. Fitz.
I know.
Think of his first name.
Adkins.
No, he was a Fitz.
Oh, it's Fitz's son.
Yes, Fitz's
son.
Oh,
I'd heard of a daughter. I don't think I'd heard of a son.
Well, I think it was his son. I don't know. I'm not real sure. I'd have to look it up. It may be on my map, but I didn't bring my big old map.
Which map is this?
Oh, that one that's tattered and torn from
school
way
district?
Back in the old school district.
Okay, yeah, I've got one here.
It,
maybe
it probably will
that.
Show that. So.
I've got one here. In fact, I was going to give it to you, but maybe you've already got one. On the other hand, if this is in better shape than yours...
Well, mine's in terrible shape. I wish I could have...
this is a copy of one we had. Let's see. Now, there's... Let's get some weight on this. We're clear over here, so I think you need to pull it over quite a ways. Let's see. Yeah, here's... Here's Love. Here's Kivlano. Fabian, wait a minute. Farkas. Here's Loud. And.
Here's Stimple.
Here's Home.
Yeah, but they doesn't show.
I didn't remember another Fitz. Just Dr. Fitz is the only one that I think is on this.
Yeah. This was Fitz's. Either son or son-in-law's place right there.
Oh, Bert bought that then?
He bought this. Bert homesteaded originally out on the
Farmer's Loop.
Farmer's Loop up on Greenock Road.
Mm-hmm.
And he was down in a chunk of ice lenses and he was failing every year. Just like I did when I started. And they went to the Nazarene Church. And Dr. Fitz was preaching there, and he talked Bert into coming out by him, because he said, you know, you'll be able to raise something there. And of course, their weather was so much better there than on the Greenock Road.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
Bert Stemple's place was originally Dr. Fitz's son.
It's either son or
or something. Some relation. Okay.
And Dr. Fitz then owned. This piece right here,
mm-hmm.
And so eventually, when Dr. Fitz left, Bert bought most of that.
Who was Kay Stimple? Does that make any sense to you?
No.
Because Mrs. Stimple was Leah, right?
Yeah, her name was Leah. No, I don't.
Well,
I don't remember it ever being. In anybody's name except hers.
This could be an error too.
And this road isn't laid out right. This road goes here and over here.
Yeah.
This is not the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bert had bought all of Fitz's place, and then he had subdivided five lots down this line here, and because Dr. Fitz had allowed John Holm to put a road down their property line right there, down
to
Fitz's place.
Now?
Where that little road is now.
Okay.
And and then after. After the Chino Hot Springs Road became usable, then John Holmes put the road on down to the Chino Hot Springs Road.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't put the road down until after the road was there. The road wasn't there until the military graveled the. This was the Bennett Road, and. This was just kind of faulted along the ridge of this hill, because that's where it's fairly dry,
mm-hmm.
and so they went on down there. So the military then hauled their material from Fox, and they got permission from the landowners to use that road and upgrade it. And so they they put tailings on the Bennett Road all the way down, and then, sad to say, Farkas and Loud kind of got in a big tiff, and so Farkas wouldn't let the road go by his house. Mm-hmm. It used to go by his house to Loud's. Because that's what it did in every case, you know.
Sure.
It went by Bennett's, you know, stopped mm-hmm. at Bennett's, then it went on past Bennett to the next place, and then down to the next
sure.
place, and on down. And it used to go right by Farkas's house down to Loud's, and I suppose they originally were friends, but they were both fairly hot-tempered. They were both pretty smart guys, you know. It's just a shame that they didn't get along better.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why the south end of the Bennett Road is straight.
Mm-hmm.
Every place else it just winds
yeah.
around between homesteads. But once they got down to Farkas's place, he says, you got to make that road straight, because
mm-hmm.
I don't want that road going to Loud's place go by my place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. It's, you know, kind of goofy, but that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then when they got it built down to there, and then they crossed the Columbia Creek Valley to go to the military place, you see, that made all that usable, because the hilltops you could drive on pretty well, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they tied it into the Steel Creek here, and then they finally got it good enough there across that valley before the Bennett
right.
Road. But I can remember lots of times that we couldn't get through there, and we'd have to go around the Steel
mm-hmm.
Creek to get to
mm-hmm.
town in the spring, you know. You'd have frost boils and stuff, but...
Well, that's
cool,
yeah, now.
You thought the thing was supposed to beep, or what?
Well, the old one did, yeah. This one knows it. And I've got to watch that light. Okay, so... Okay, well, when did John home?
Well, now, John Holm, he must have been there probably 2 or 3 years ahead of me. He must have been there in about, I'm trying to remember where he was there in 50 or not. It was around 50 or 51, I suspect,
mm-hmm.
that he was there. I went out when I was going to university, we used to take field trips to visit the farms, and there weren't really that many farms
no.
to visit. I remember visiting Burt's farm, you know. And I think we even went to the egg farm and
the egg things. Farm being Brockman's.
Yeah, Brockman's. And then later on, there was another big egg farm up where the cross country ski slope is.
And Birch Hill.
Yeah, that little house is still there, I think.
Huh.
They did a pretty nice job with eggs. But anyway,
the Holmes came out in about 50, you think?
I think 50, 51 or
mm-hmm.
something. They were fairly well established when we got there. I think he had about 10 acres cleared there by the house. And then he had... another, let's see, maybe 10 acres across the road, and then about 20 acres maybe to the west, down in the, toward town there. And it would have been, he had a field down here, and he had about a 10 acre field here, and he had about a 10 acre field there, and that's all he ever farmed. Some of the famous pictures are showing Edith out there hoeing cabbage in this field. John had a bad back, so Edith did most of the hard work.
The hard work. Right.
And when she got polio, then things kind of changed, and they had to go to town because.
Oh, I'd forgotten that. I knew they went to town, of course.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that she had polio. Huh.
Yeah. She survived it, but she did quite well.
Yeah.
But she was, after I worked for the Farmers Co-op, I took over as inspector from Mark Buswell, and I was the produce inspector, and also worked half-time at the university with Callio. So when I would go out, when I inspected potatoes around the whole valley, and there were people like Paul Elbert, who was a moose of a man, you know, there was nobody in the Fairbanks area who ever stacked 100-pound sacks more than 5 high. Edith would do it 6 high. She was the only person on my route that could stack 100-pound sacks.
How in the world did she do it?
I don't know. She was tough.
I guess. Oh, I wanted to ask about your house, which was their house, but wasn't that, there's something special about that house, wasn't there?
Well, now that house was one that Johnny bought, one of those kind where you buy, it's all, you buy the pieces and it's a numbered house. In other words,
Put
together. Now, he actually never lived in it. He never built it. It was built by, I think, one of the Hernings. Maybe Bill, I don't know. I bet one of the Hernings had known.
Huh, no one's mentioned that.
See, Johnny lived right on the corner up, about right there. Right on the little road came down there. And then
came off of Steel Creek then to get into
He had a little house there.
Uh-huh.
And it was made in pieces. He worked at the carpenter shop out university. I mean, out at the Ladd Air Force Base. And apparently he was allowed to haul scraps home, and it was made out of little birch logs and little pieces of wood that he could get in his vehicle.
Right. Oh, yes. Well, it was part of the course of the...
Oh, yeah. It was.
Yeah.
But Edith was wonderful at making cinnamon rolls. She was a fantastic cook. And I remember sometimes we'd go on a big sledding party, and of course, in those days, the hills they weren't cut out, so they were a lot steeper, and so we'd get Bert and Leah and John and Edith and Pat and us, and it seemed to me there was another couple. I can't right offhand. Might have been even two more sometimes. But sometimes we'd sled toward town from the top of this hill, because it was really steep in those days, and you could go probably 40 miles an hour. But we really liked the Herding Hill. That was because there was practically no traffic on it, and we usually go sledding at night, and then somebody would drive the car down with the lights on, and we'd take turns, people driving the car. Mm-hmm.
Well, Herding Hill, you mean 4 Mile, there where it starts at 4 Mile, or? Down to Steel Creek?
We'd use this one, the one right here.
On this side?
Yeah, going east.
Oh!
We did the other way too, but we did this one quite a bit too.
Toward down the Hopper Creek.
Well, this road, your road turns off right in that saddle. Right over next. That was a pretty steep hill.
Okay.
And we could go 50 miles an hour, and we'd get two people on those little flexible flyers. and that was kind of interesting. There was only one couple, and the guy always was on the bottom, and the girl was on top, except. You got to remember, John had a bad back, so Edith was on the bottom and John was on top. But John always had to win. He was very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So one time, Bert, being the kind of guy he was, he had a little piece of baling wire and he tied it to one of John's runners. I mean, and Bert and Leah went down and they beat John. Oh, and John was mortified. And then he was madder than hops when Bert told him what he did. I mean, because Johnny really was the best, you know. Of course, Johnny had to be the best at everything. But anyway, that one time Bert and Leah beat Johnny down the hill, but it was because of that little piece of bale wire. But then we'd go back to the Holmes' house, and we'd have cocoa and cinnamon rolls and something like that. It was lots of fun.
Were the woods involved in this, really?
They came later. Now, Russ was working, he was in the service at Ladd Air Force Base, and I think he had at least 12 years in, I'm not sure for sure. And Julie worked at the ELM, but Russ kind of liked the farm, and I don't know how he bumped into Bert, but anyway, when he was in the military, he used to come out and help grade potatoes at Bert's place, and that's when Bert had Ruth Zazula. We called her Cuddles. Well, Bert called her Cuddles. I mean, he always had a name for everybody, you know, and her husband was a mad Russian. And so then Russ was really quite shy, and he would very seldom talk about much of anything, and he would talk about hunting and fishing a little bit. But anyway, Bert was always doing some cutting up, but anyway, finally, that place where woods are now came up, and so Bert talked Russ into buying that place from Boris Patrick. That wasn't Patrick's place. That wasn't there. I think they bought it from somebody else. But they used to raise radishes. They did a nice job. Now I remember going over there for meetings, and Mrs. Patrick had put a great big bowl of radishes on the table, and my gosh, they were good enough. You just eat them like apples, mm-hmm. You know. They were wonderful. And so anyway, then Russ and Julie bought that place, and then when Bert decided to sell out, then he sold Russ. He would have sold Russ this 40 acres here,
below the road,
and then 15 acres here, because that 5-acre deal took 25 acres,
yeah.
So there was only 15 here and 40 here, and then I bought the 40 acres above the road here, and then Mary McGuire bought. She bought this, and then she, I don't know where she homesteaded this or not, but she may have homesteaded this.
Well, yeah, they were old-timers out here.
Yeah, they came out here. Bert let them put a road up right across from this road. It
mm-hmm. Well,
right up the
still,
hill.
Still there.
And they called it Bearfanks Boulevard, and they went out to McGuire's place up there, and the original place was on Bert's land. I used to farm potatoes up there, and then after McGuire's bought it, I still farmed it for quite a few years up there.
So I'm not sure where McGuire's were.
The house was right about here.
So they were
on Bert's place.
Okay.
But I think they homesteaded this 160 up there. Now they have a house up about here somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, and they, I don't know. But they were there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And of course, this was the Mary Beth the Children's home.
All right.
That was really a nice place. They did a really good job there.
What happened to that? Any idea?
Bryce has owned it all.
Well, I realize that, but did the Children's home lose their funding?
Well, what happened was the state changed their idea. They had made a study, and they said, for years we've been taking in all these native kids, and then when they grow up, they abandon their kids, and they go into children's homes, and they've got three generations of kids living in children's homes. And they, so then they said, well, we're going to try a new policy and try to put kids in foster homes so maybe they can learn, because they never learned what a family was. I mean, it's really hard to learn what a family is in a children's home. So anyway, like Pat's mother took in some foster kids, and we took in some foster kids and stuff. And
yeah, we knew other people who, I suppose the same thing basically happened to the Pentecostals.
Yeah, it was the same thing. I mean, there wasn't anything wrong with either home. It was just that the state had changed their idea about what to do, and it probably was a good idea. I don't know. But they were both, I thought, very well run operations. I, of course, I really liked Bob Johnson. He was a great guy.
Okay, yeah, and his name is on that corridor there.
Yeah, but he had, they had the home.
Yeah, I realize that. But I understand that was, who had the dairy down here at the bottom of the hill?
Oh, Funk.
Funk apparently homesteaded that originally.
Yeah, I think it was Funk's homestead originally. And then they left the country and went outside, and then they came back, and then they got this deal.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't.
Who else is in there? They want to ask about. There were so many interesting. We have Cora Gamble on tape. We have Ruth Sozula on tape. You'll hear your name a few times.
Oh, no.
And Julie Wood.
Uh-huh. Well, great.
And all the Hernings that are still alive, except Bill.
Yeah.
And so there's, Maddie Lee. She talked about the old Steel Creek Road coming up off the highway and that terrible hill.
Oh, that was. I remember sometimes I would have to back down three times and try to make it, you know. And sometimes you just have to give up and not make it, you know. It was terrible.
Oh.
Bert Stimple just wouldn't believe it if he were to come out here now.
No.
He did.
No.
But he'll never come back. It's just too hard for him.
I would imagine so. Well, are there any other names on there that bring up some memories?
Well, I don't know. Now, Carl Wilson had a homestead here, but he's the one that owned the hot spring.
Yeah, that's what I assumed. It was the same person.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, getting back to Holmes House, well, who did build that then, the numbered?
Well, you see, Holmes sold his homestead to
let me dump that out and give you a fresh
This is just fine.
It's cold.
No, that's
this
all
is hot.
No, that's all right. This is fine. Thank you ever so much. To Ray Gross and Ed Rusing. They were both, you see, Ed was the banker and Ray had the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had farm backgrounds, and they kind of made fun of most of the homesteaders because most of us were so poor, we really couldn't do anything right. We did things the best we could with nothing, but they had access to money, and the bank wouldn't loan anybody money if they knew you homesteaded. Now, once in a while, I'd get a loan if I told them I had a job, because sometimes I had to get a job to support the homestead, you know. But they just didn't trust homesteaders, banks didn't. So anyway, I guess they got together one day and they thought, well, you know, it'd be good for the community if we just showed them how real farmers can do it. So they bought John Holmes's homestead, and then they decided, well, they would lease Burt's with an option to buy. They leased all of Burt's, so they had. That gave them the two homesteads together there, so they had plenty of land, and they were going to really be able to, and they had the finances, and they bought, I think, the first potato harvester in the area, and they they did everything right, except, of course, neither one of them could work because they had jobs, you know. So they hired, they were Mormons, and so they hired good Mormon kids, and they were good people too, you know, they were, but they didn't have any experience, and they, you know, talking about farming and farming is two different things. And then if you're hiring somebody, they might want to go to work at 8 o'clock and quit at 5, whereas a homesteader might go to work at 5 and quit at 8 or 10, and there's a big difference. And then of course they got paid and stuff, and well, you know, they turned trailer loads of potatoes over, and you know, they just had one trouble after another, and so finally it only took Ed and Ray a year or so to decide, well, we could have showed him, but you know, we just couldn't get the right help. So then they sold out here, and they both went to Arizona, you know. And Ray had a supermarket up Prescott, I think, in Arizona, and Ed went back in the banking business down in Arizona.
Didn't they also try to set up something out of the LA Highway?
Well,
someplace.
I don't think it was them. I think it was some of the guys that had worked there. It was a group of Mormons.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were very nice, and they were going to raise carrots and stuff, and but they just didn't. Well, they just didn't make it, because there again, it's not an easy easy thing to do. So so then eventually, now I probably shouldn't even tell you this story, but Loud had a, although he had a master's degree, and he was a really smart guy, but his temper was not so good. And actually, back when I was manager of the Farmers Co-op, Loud tried to join the co-op, and Holmes was one of the big members on the board, and there were several other members, but Johnny spoke up, you know, pretty much, and he said, well, I've looked around, and we have got enough farmers in the co-op to supply all the stuff that they need in the Fairbanks area, and if we let anybody else in the co-op, that means that we're going to have to cut down. And he says, I don't think we ought to do it. Well, and here Loud tried to join the co-op, and they wouldn't let him in. But I was manager of the co-op, so I was the one that was blamed for it. I had nothing to do with it. In fact, I didn't think it was a good idea, but anyhow. And that, so that made Loud mad at the whole, everybody in the co-op, but especially me, because I was the manager that had to tell him they wouldn't let him in.
Sure.
So anyway, I've forgotten, this was probably several years later, and this was after Ray Gross and Ed had decided to move on to warmer pastures down in Arizona, and so they had Earl Cook handling the property, and they were just renting out the house, and I think maybe once or twice Loud did rent a field or so, you know, but most of the time it just sat empty. But anyway, I remember I was down in my little potato cellar, grading taters, and Loud came storming in, and I don't know what I did, but it must have been bad, whatever it was. But I took some of his market, I didn't do it intentionally, but or something, but he thought I did or something, and so he said, Henry, I've just had it with you, he says. If you don't do what I tell you to do, he says, I'm going to go rent that place, and I'm going to put it in potatoes, and I'm going to put you out of business. And, you know, I believed him, too. He would have done it. But I was so close to being out of business anyway, it wasn't funny. So anyway, I talked to Pat about it, and I said, you know, I don't know, he could do that if he went and rented that land and he planted that all in potatoes, it'd sure be off the top. So I said, well, I think I'll go down and talk to Earl Cook. So I went down and talked to Earl. Well, Dick Loud had tried to buy that Holmes property from the But he tried to get an FHA loan. FHA? Anyway, he tried to get a loan, but they wouldn't loan him the money. And so I talked to Earl, and I said, Earl, Les said he's going to rent this place and put me out of business if I don't shape up. And I don't know how to shape up. So I said, what would it cost me to rent the place? I mean, just so I could let it sit. Mm-hmm. just so he couldn't rent it. And he said, well, Henry, I think you ought to try to buy it. And I said, man, there's no way in the world I could afford to buy it. He says, you know, that's been on the market for years, and they really would like to sell it. He says, if you could come up with $5,000 down, I'll see if I can't get them to, you know, to let you make payments. And so he wrote to Ray and Ed, and so we made a deal, and that's how we bought the place. I would no more have bought that place than nothing. And it's the only thing that saved me, you know, because
yeah.
We were having trouble down here. When we first homesteaded, all this land was permafrost, and it was really cold, and we'd get frost in July sometimes, and we always got them in August. And over here, Johnny's, you know, they wouldn't get frost until maybe the middle of September. And so I'd work every bit as hard, sometimes harder, and I'd get half the crop they'd get,
yeah.
Because you lost half the growing season. So anyway, when we moved over there, then so I give Les Loud credit for making it possible for me to survive. I mean, it really wasn't his plan, but that's what actually happened. Isn't that strange? You just never know.
Somebody mentioned Mrs. Loud having some kind of a business over, I guess, where the root cellar is now. Cooking, making potato chips. What in the world was it? Do you remember anything?
I don't remember that. I remember, you know, Joe Balch making potato chips down at Salcha. But I don't remember Mrs. Loud ever working off the farm.
Somebody, it's in one of the tapes,
uh-huh.
You'll run across it when you get copies of all these. We'll have to pursue that with somebody else and see. But it was some kind of it came up in connection with the fact that Mrs. Funk had sold bread for a while, had made pastries and things, and
uh-huh.
They said yes, and Mrs. Loud had done something, was apparently selling some kind of food out of their place.
It's funny that I don't remember.
I imagine it didn't last very long, probably.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's more than I've ever heard about that place, your place. That's interesting. Lodge came up from what, Kentucky, Tennessee, someplace?
I think Kentucky.
And I thought they said it was having to do with asthma. One of the kids, Dick, had a health problem, one of the kids, something.
I don't know.
I've been trying to get a hold of him,
uh-huh.
And so far he didn't.
I think, you know, I think he's done quite well in the mining business. Now, he had a restaurant downtown.
Yeah, along with his mother, or at least it had her name on it.
Oh, well, that's
Carmel's there in Devorah Mall.
Yeah.
Again, not for very long. But,
well, it must have been a couple of years or so, because my son worked for him for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe longer than I remember. Well, who'd you know up on Bennett Road?
Well, Chuck Fabian's still around, I think. Of course, you know, this is the one that Minded Howard has now.
Yeah.
And Terry Moran has subdivided most of his place, but he still owns part of it.
Terry Moran, I've talked to. I have a tape of his memories, which had some interesting. Everybody adds something.
Uh-huh.
It's really neat the way it builds. Bernie Rainier is long gone.
Yeah,
I think we missed getting on tape, and that thing is still running out. That Charles C. Kivlin was the son of Charles here north of the road.
Yeah. We put in the, well, I guess he had a little trail, and we put in a road back to our place, and it went, you know, to his quarters, mm-hmm. and it went across there to our place. And
is that the same road that's still in there?
Yeah, it is.
More or less.
Growing up, and
yeah.
It's like this now. You
right.
know. It's.
Yeah, roads don't last.
No, that land is really sunk. And there is a well down at the bottom of the hill that kind of keeps the road kind of washed out. I always had to redo the culverts and stuff down there.
This is a built well? Or
yeah, it was a drilled well.
Drilled well.
For the military site.
Yeah.
It turned artesian on it?
It was artesian.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Well, there was
so after they left, I said, well, by golly, I'm gonna fix that. I'll just turn, they had a big valve on it, so I'll just turn that well off. You know what it did? It jacked the pipe up out of the ground about 6 feet, and I opened it back up again. It just pushed that pipe right up in the air. But it's still running.
Yeah.
It's not good water. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah. Wasn't there also an artesian well over on
Charlie Kimmon had an artesian well,
yeah.
And we had one.
Any place along the creek there, basically.
Yeah. We had 12 pounds pressure here because I had a potato storage there, and we could even wash potatoes without turning the pump on,
yeah.
And you could irrigate. Pat's mother would irrigate the radish patch and stuff. We had lettuce and radishes and different things down there and stuff. And I tried carrots down by the creek. Oh, the soil just looked absolutely fantastic. It was really beautiful, peat and dark and stuff. And it was kind of interesting. It shows you how you can overdo something. There was kind of a little slope there down to the creek. And we did use the creek for irrigation too. We had a little pump that we could irrigate the lettuce and the radishes and the carrots and stuff. But our carrots would grow these little white roots on the
mm-hmm.
side of them because the moisture was too high down there in the creek. And then right the further down we got, the harder it was to raise anything. So I had it tested. I said, oh, I guess it must be real acid, you know, it looked like it could be acid soil. Well, it turned out it wasn't the least bit acid, but it was just way too high in fertilizer because with the irrigating on the hillside, all the, you know, I mean, not all, but some of it,
mm-hmm.
until it just got too much. So you can overdo it.
Yep.
I tell people I didn't make a success because of all the good things I did. I made a success because of all my failures.
It's been interesting to watch that so-called farmer's market at the fairgrounds and the various people that come in with various things. And their hopes of they're going to be doing this and this and this going to be.